effective fitness combatives mission is to provide quality content and education to law enforcement officers through proven science-driven fitness and combatives. This EFC user course is a complete online program designed to elevate your approach to combatives with the ability to learn and train anywhere, anytime. Access the course materials through your browser at efcombatives.com or from the EF Combatives app available for download through Apple and Google Play stores. The course is broken down into easy-to-digest micro-learning modules, enabling you to move through the lecture, technique demonstration videos, and additional resources at your own pace. You also have direct access to industry-leading instructors for questions and feedback related to your training. After completion of this course, you will receive an EFC user certification that is valid for 2 years. We highly suggest you continue your combatives training at an EFC certified academy and continue on to other advanced courses within our curriculum. EF Combatives and EFT will be attending the TAC Ops Law Enforcement Training Conference this year in Verona, New York, April 25th through the 28th. EFC's very own Jay Wadsworth, Director of Combatives and co-founder, will be there teaching defensive tactics, things like weapons-based entanglements, single officer apprehension, handcuffing procedures, searching procedures, and so on and so forth. Jay is a wealth of knowledge, and you will learn a lot just from that short stint at this conference. Be sure to check us out at booth 416 and say hi to the team. If we can help you out in any way, don't hesitate to ask. At this conference, there's going to be over 150 vendors showcasing the latest tools and technology, networking opportunities at the event, raffle prizes throughout the day. And don't forget, there's also two more TACOps conferences this year, Nashville, Tennessee, August 23rd through the 25th, and then also Washington, D.C., September 6th through the 8th. Be sure to check the TACOps website for more information and how to register. Welcome to the Be Effective Podcast, episode 69, Kara Smith. Kara began her career as an intelligence analyst in the United States Air Force, where she deployed to both Iraq and Afghanistan to provide support on critical missions for the NSA. Later, she was hired by the FBI, where she specialized in counterterrorism. Currently, she works with the Liver Fund as her chief analyst, where she helps to fight against human trafficking. Kara is a reliable source of information when it comes to fighting human trafficking operations, how to talk to victims, and tools for law enforcement officers on when they encounter human trafficking in the field. Very informative episode. If you are a law enforcement officer, I highly suggest you listen to this entire episode. She even goes into evidence collection so that you can have a solid case against these trash humans. Also, please continue to support the Deliver Fund, one of my companies, EFT. We were able to raise over $12,000 in less than 24 hours with the sale of our Reaper collection. We sold shirts, Ranger panties, stickers, and patches. We plan on doing another launch of the Reaper collection later on this year with some rash guards, grappling shorts and training shorts, some stickers and patches as well. So stand by for that. And again, 100% of the proceeds will go towards fighting human trafficking through Deliver Fund. Without further ado, episode 69 with Kara Smith. Enjoy. Kara, thank you for your time. We were just chatting a little bit about what we're going to discuss in this podcast, and she has a lot of information for you guys. So introduce yourself and give a quick background of who you are.
So thank you so much for having me. I'm Kara Smith. I am the chief of analytics for Deliver Fund, which is a nonprofit private intelligence firm that combats human trafficking, primarily here in the United States. We've been around since 2014, and I've been with them for the last 5.5 years.
That is awesome. Yeah, we are a huge fan of what you guys do over at Deliver Fund. If you guys don't know, those that bought some of the Reaper stuff, all that money went straight to Deliver Fund to help Kara and her team do the Lord's work. And we definitely will continue to support them any way we can. But let's talk a little bit more about you and your background and kind of where you came from and how you ended up in the situation you're in now.
Yeah, absolutely. So I went into the Air Force right out of high school. When I went into the Air Force, I made sure that I went into the intelligence world. And gosh, that was back in like 2004, 2005. And so for 6.5 years, I was an intelligence analyst, primarily counterterrorism work. And I deployed to Iraq and I deployed to Afghanistan, and I got to work out of the NSA and I got to do all that targeting cool stuff, which to this day now, as I've grown and matured, I cannot figure out why they give 20-somethings that much power. But I enjoyed it and I had a lot of fun doing that work. And then after 6.5 years, I got out and I contracted out of the NSA. And then I got, believe it or not, I got bored with the NSA work and went over to the FBI and did counterterrorism watch listing. So any of you law enforcement listening, when you have a known or suspected terrorist, you know what you're supposed to do, I hope. And I would be on the other end of those calls, which was really, really rewarding. I don't think people realize that that real-time information and intelligence is so important across the country when I'm trying to defeat terrorism. I went ahead and had 2 kids and I stopped working for a little while. My brain rotted. I was like, oh my gosh, I need to go back to work. I have this insatiable need to make sure bad people are being held accountable for their actions. So I updated my LinkedIn profile, and my CEO now, Nick McKinley at Deliver Fund, he reached out to me because he was looking for an intelligence analyst in the area, which I was living at the time, which I'm still living here. I'm in the Albuquerque area. And he basically is like, you want to hunt human traffickers? And I'm like, hell yeah, I want to hunt human traffickers. What is that? So I had to learn a completely new target set. I had the analyst background, and I had those chops, but I had to learn a new target set. And so it took me some time to really understand that, but I actually learned that from law enforcement officers and survivors of human trafficking. And that was 5.5 years ago when I started that. And so I started as a, you know, part-time stay-at-home mom targeting bad guys and, you know, from my desk right here. And now I'm the chief of analytics for the organization.
That's kind of cool. Part-time mom, superhero part-time as well. That's pretty dope. So how was that transition? Because obviously doing the military stuff, that's more outside of the states, right? And that's obviously a different target set, probably different set of tools, different way to gather intelligence, right? And actually make it useful for whatever you were doing in the military, right? So obviously that kind of process had to change. How did your mindset of, all right, I went from hunting terrorists to hunting other shitty people inside of the United States? So like, how did that mindset just shift? Because obviously it has to mess with you a little bit, because obviously human trafficking hits, because obviously you're a mother and that could probably hit a little more at home. So kind of what was your mindset there?
So moving to the, like, a, you know, a CONUS, a continental United States mindset. One, it was easier because they speak English. I don't need linguists, right? But facts. I think it was almost easier in aspect because the cultural shift was a little more easy to understand, right? Because I am from the United States and I can understand the language of primarily, especially moving to the trafficking target set, I've, you know, been using social media constantly and there's so much information out there. When you're working overseas, the information intelligence is amazing, but it's like it's all done in a classified manner and there's so many rules and stipulations. And like if you look the wrong way, all of a sudden you've got an inspector general over your shoulder and it's really hard to, you know, do what you do. And there's so many procedures that you have to follow, which I know law enforcement understands. But here in the US, as a nonprofit, private entity, you're really able to do a lot more work when you don't have, you know, basically procedural handcuffs on you all the time. And that's why I love working with Deliver Fund, because our job is actually to make law enforcement's job easier, because we're directly equipping, training, advising, and building out that technology for law enforcement. And when doing so, we're allowed a much broader space to do that and find out what works specifically, instead of, you know, completely being hampered down by a policy.
Yeah. And that can be very frustrating. I could see how that could be frustrating, because what you guys are doing, I feel like there shouldn't be any restrictions. I feel like what you guys, it's like, okay, well, human trafficking is bad. You know, the exploitation of children is also bad. So we should just be like, well, you guys stop this, please, at all costs. At least that would be my political, agenda on the topic, but I'm not in politics, and that's probably for good reason. But bad reason, I guess. I don't know. I think most people would agree with my outlook on life and politics. Anyways, that's a whole different podcast. But let's talk about how you work with law enforcement. Like so Deliver Fund obviously gathers intelligence and then delivers that to law enforcement. So what does that process look like?
So, you know, primarily we start with making our relationships with law enforcement through our training. And so we, you know, have taken actually our counterterrorism methodologies and how we do that intelligence work and just shifted it to the human trafficking target set. We saw that law enforcement was underfunded, undertrained, overworked, and they definitely didn't have the technology and the training that we used to have. And so our main mission was to make sure that they had that. And so training first, develop that relationship out with law enforcement, and then working with them by providing intelligence reports and teaching them how to read those intelligence reports and that work. So whether it be a cold outreach, which is very rare, or a former training graduate from our courses, it's working with them directly to, you know, help them develop out that intelligence online, primarily through open source intelligence and different places, to provide basically just this, you know, the silver platter. Hey, this is your trafficker. This is the victim. This is how they're connected. If you make this arrest and you make this case, like, they're going to have to plea out. Because with human trafficking in itself, specifically here in the United States on the domestic sex trafficking level, traffickers can't make their money unless they're advertising en masse. And they do that on the front-facing internet. And when they do that, there's fingerprints all over the internet. When a trafficker touches the internet or he puts his victim up for sale on the internet, I can find them because they've touched the internet. And as we all know in today's society, what goes out on the internet never gets erased. There's always a way to backtrack it. There's always a way to find that connection. And so providing that information to law enforcement, also supporting operations. So human trafficking task force and vice units, they do certain operations, and we go ahead and help them, you know, identify those victims, identify those traffickers, give them the intelligence they need to work efficiently and ensure that there's officer safety taking place. Our biggest lift right now, how we're helping law enforcement, is I'm talking about all this data. I'm talking about everything out on the internet. The biggest thing is getting all of that scalable for law enforcement to be able to use it more easily and more fluently and understand it, put it in their hand, so that when they're working a case, that intelligence is right there in front of them. So we are building out tech that protects, that helps identify those leads in and make it easier for detectives to develop out their cases.
Awesome. That's great. And when you say law enforcement training, is this training that any law enforcement officer can attend online, in person? How do they get trained by you guys?
Yeah, so we have a quarterly free training, which is our basic human trafficking intelligence for law enforcement. That is a 3 or 4 hour just virtual course that is mainly meant for patrol or people who are just starting to come to light of what human trafficking is. I think the statistics out there that only 17% of all law enforcement in the U.S. actually have any kind of human trafficking training. And that's unacceptable, right? And then going further, our counter human trafficking intelligent operators course is a 3-day course that is for people who are going to be doing human trafficking investigations. And currently, at request, we're going out there to different departments and agencies and like mass training law enforcement. And that's where we teach that deep dive, you know, intelligence and pulling apart all that open source and graphing out the information and teaching the methodology of it all. I don't think this will be out in time, but our next quarterly training is April 19th. And so law enforcement, as long as you are a law enforcement officer, you can go to deliverfund.law and go to training and you can actually register for that course. And, you know, we also ensure that survivors' voices are heard and we have a survivor speak, because you're not really going to understand and get what human trafficking is like until you have a survivor tell you what her life was like or his life is like and how it happened. And it really brings in that understanding of what goes on. But any law enforcement officer that is involved with the law enforcement department can come and take that basic course.
So obviously you guys also do the in-person courses as well. Can they request to host you guys at their agency?
Yes.
As well?
Yeah.
Okay.
And you could also contact us through the deliverfund.law for that as well. And, you know, speak to our law enforcement liaison and how to make that happen.
And that is pretty frustrating that 17% of law enforcement don't get much training on human trafficking. And you and I were talking prior.
No, 17% of law enforcement are the only ones that are trained.
Only ones that are trained.
Have received it.
Excuse me.
It's even larger. The problem is larger than that. So the majority of law enforcement in the U.S. have not even been trained on the basics of what human trafficking is.
Right. Like what it looks like, signs to look for, and things like that. And guys, they offer free training. So I'm all about free quality training. Definitely check that out. We'll put the link in the show notes. People can just go ahead and click and go straight there and go ahead and attend. So when it comes to training the cops from a patrol aspect, because obviously that's probably where, I mean, obviously yeah, like you specialize, you have your vice units, your street crimes, those guys and girls doing their thing. If you had to pick top three things to look for someone on patrol, what would you say those top three things are that could be a sign of human trafficking?
The top three things I would look for is during a DV call to a hotel, right? If there's a DV call to the shady motel in town, that's your number one clue.
Stereotypical scenario.
Right. And when you're at that DV call, the female is being advertised as, you know, a sex worker. If that DV call is if she has somebody that is controlling her. So if that supposed sex worker, which a sex worker is completely different than a human trafficking victim, a sex worker is there on her own, independent, is probably not going to be selling herself out of the shady hotel. And the DV call is in between her manager or her pimp. That's when you need to go ahead and split them up and have a conversation and not be accusatory. Don't call her a prostitute. Don't call her a hooker. Just humanize her is what you have to do. But those are the main calls where you're likely to come in contact with that and that what you're going to see and see that she's under control or the influence of somebody else and having to perform those services and make that money and she's not being able to keep it. So that's like the number one thing I would look out for. Now, when you go into that sort of call, and some more indicators is her room is going to be just destroyed. There's going to be fast food wrappers everywhere. There's going to be skimpy clothing. There's going to be condoms. There's going to be lubricant. There's going to be sometimes, usually, two beds, one that she sleeps in and one that she performs the acts in with her purchasers, the the Johns, right? So that's what you're going to see. If you're talking to her, you're going to, you know, have a conversation with her, see what she knows, right, about her job. Like, oh, like, well, how much money are you making? Well, it's good money. You know, make sure that you're not there to get her in trouble, right? You're not there to get her in trouble. You just want to make sure she's okay in this domestic violence situation or this disturbance that you were called to. And if she's, if she is being trafficked, it's very likely she's, you know, not going to know exactly where she is. She's being moved constantly. It's very likely that she is, you know, has branding tattoos on her, names on her chest, on her neck, thighs of a male name. One of my favorite indicators is she's wearing a wedding ring. Like, why would she be wearing a wedding ring? It's because her trafficker has manipulated her into thinking that she is the wifey and that she is in charge of her situation when she really isn't. So those are just like slight indicators and just like a scratch of the basic course we actually do teach. We get more into detail with those indicators and how to do even some little like open source searches on them from your phone before you figure things out and continue on with the questioning. You're looking for somebody who's in a position of vulnerability, right? Somebody that is, you know, just not all there. There's a very good chance that she is on drugs. It's a very good chance that her trafficker is her drug dealer and is making her do that work throughout the day to make a quota to get her fix. And that's one of the most common situations that you're going to see. So you, as an officer, might walk in there and you're like, it's a, you know, a drug addict prostitute. And this guy, you know, slapped her across the face. And now she's saying, oh, I love him. I love him. He's the most amazing thing. I don't want him to get in trouble. Leave us alone. Go away. I don't want to press charges. You know, the whole scenario.
Right. Sure.
And you might have charges pressed or not, but there might be something deeper going on there. And the best thing that you can do is, you know, humanize her, offer services, show that you are there to help her, maybe call in the local victim services organization. They have a talk with her and see what they can do to help her out, to find her a better place to stay for the night, certain things like that. And that's the thing, is when you see all these little indicators, which I've barely scratched the surface, the most important thing you can do is humanize her and show that you were a way out and not the scary cop that showed up that's going to hurt her, because that's what her trafficker is going to teach to her, is that,
right, that cops are bad.
That cops are bad. They're going to take you. They're going to rape you. They're going to kill you. That's what traffickers teach them. And show her that that wasn't you. You know, leave your phone number behind, leave a card and whatever it may be, because it's highly unlikely she's going to be like, yeah, I want help. But make sure that she has your information, the resources, and be that one shining light that could have helped her in that situation. You might even get a call 3 to 4 years later. Never know. Maybe you're that officer who's had contact with her now 7 times. And your demeanor can change even after the 7th time and show that, you know, you're there to assist her out of that situation. I mean, it's even as simple as striking up a conversation about food or where they're from and like, where'd you grow up? Oh gosh, me too. Or whatever it is. It's like, well, what's your favorite movie right now? It's like, just humanize somebody that you believe is in a bad situation, de-escalate their fears about you. It's really important.
This episode is brought to you by Officer Privacy. Right now, data broker websites are posting your name and address online, which puts you and your family in danger. Anti-cop organizations use this information to harass and even dox you and your families without you even seeing it coming. Officer Privacy is a law enforcement owned and operated organization that specializes in removing your personal information from the internet. When you sign up with Officer Privacy, they will remove information from dangerous databases all over the world so that you can enjoy an extra layer of protection and privacy. Officer Privacy also monitors these sites so that if anyone tries to put up your information, they will take it back down. Reduce your chances of being a victim and protect you and your family's private information. Go to officerprivacy.com/beeffective to sign up and learn more.
Yeah. And I would say too, it's tough for cops that just the social interaction, just like the social skills right now, as I see younger police officers, because one thing I did before I left law enforcement was train new cops. One of their biggest shortcomings or their flaws that you're seeing is their ability to communicate with someone. It's very hard for someone to level with somebody with no life experience, right? Like it's very hard for someone, just like you said, who's 24 years old, a police officer, and they go to a DV call at the shady hotel and the person's in their 30s, right? 34, and they've been through hell, right? Now, they may, I'm not saying that's all cops, they may, you know, do what their FTO did. And that's why the FTO position is so important for cops, is train their cops the right way to have those conversations, to pick up on those things. One thing that I have a question about is the utilization of kids. Because I'm assuming the majority of victims are women. That's probably goes without saying. With that being said, the utilization of their children in order to make more money for their pimp, their manager, their handler. What does that look like?
So yeah, 96% of victims of trafficking are female. We'll refer to the pimp, the trafficker, as the trafficker, right? They utilize their children, the victim's children, immensely. They use them as a gambling place. There's traffickers that will have children with their victim to use that as a chess piece. An instance was right here in Albuquerque, New Mexico, a few years ago. I was assisting law enforcement on an in-call operation. And the victim they went into, she was in her 30s, right? She had a phone that was what they would call a ho phone. The phone is only for communicating with either purchasers or their trafficker. The trafficker was not on site, but she gave consent to law enforcement to look through the phone. And I'm sitting over the shoulder of analyst that ripped the phone, and I'm looking at it, and there's straight out threats from her trafficker of, you don't make your quota tonight, I'm leaving your baby in the intersection, and I'm going to call Child Protective Services and let them know what you're doing. It's like, you'll never get to keep your baby.
Yeah. Leverage.
Yes. They use the child as leverage. And then a lot of the times those kids are brought up in those communities. And so a trafficker will have multiple victims, and one of those victims is watching all the kids at that point in time. The other girls are out working, and then it becomes cyclic, right? It becomes generational. And so those children are raised up thinking this is a way of life, and they're either raised up to be, you know, victims, or then a lot of the males are raised to be traffickers themselves and, you know, aspire to have all that cash on hand at all times, aspire to go buy that high end stuff. And so, especially within the inner city, you see a lot of that generational trafficking that takes place. So the children are used as leverage all the time.
And so what you're saying too is in order to break that cycle, what you guys are doing and what law enforcement does, and also the court system obviously plays a major factor in even politics. We talked about that kind of a little bit about the handcuffs that they put on the good guys trying to stop or trying to end that cycle. And that can be very frustrating as well. Have you experienced any, I'm sure you have. Have you experienced any of the political handcuffs on, maybe not you guys specifically, but for law enforcement?
So first of all, law enforcement themselves, the detectives, the officers, they're angels in disguise. They do all the work. They're working too late. They're working too long. And the real frustrating part about it is they do have handcuffs on because they have to work directly with the prosecutor, especially in human trafficking cases, to ensure that it's even a case worth trying. And so it's really dependent on the prosecutor. And so like the DAs and the AUSAs on the federal side of following their rules and what kind of case that they're going to take. And so if there's not an aggressive prosecutor, then the area of what where that case is not going to go anywhere. We call it jurisdictional roulette.
And that's about right.
And so if we have a trafficker, say here in New Mexico, but he's working out of Dallas, Texas, the laws, for one, if it's not a federal case specifically, like if we can't get the feds on board, we're like, oh, let's take it to Texas. I mean, if that's a minor, it's life in prison. Here in Albuquerque, they might get like 6 years for trafficking a minor. Like the laws are ridiculous. So like it's, so I kind of harped on the prosecutors not being tough enough or whatnot, but then the prosecutors have to abide by the laws that they have written for them. And so the laws that are written for them are then written by the legislature, right? And the legislature writes the laws because their, you know, their constituents vote for them. It shit rolls downhill. So like,
yeah. No, it
I
does.
See it no, all the time though, and it's frustrating. I've seen prosecutors, because human trafficking cases are notoriously hard to prosecute, because you have to have the victim, no matter how much intelligence you have, no matter how large of a digital footprint you have to have the victim there to testify against their trafficker, because they are the accuser. And so because of our constitution, the trafficker has the right to face their accuser in court. And so while prosecutors who just are too afraid or ill-equipped to understand that the digital evidence is going to be so strong that he's going to end up pleading out, or she's going to, because there are female traffickers, they're going to end up pleading out, and they're too scared to take the case forward. And so like, then again, there's the laws, and it's cyclic. I'm sorry, I'm going in a circle here.
It completely makes sense. Simply because, you know, and what could be frustrating too is, and again, we briefly talked about this, but the relationship between law enforcement and the DAs and legislators and all that stuff, and how it's frustrating, because morally, I'm huge on morals and ethics and life. And obviously, the protection of our adolescents is everything, right? As a father, there's no length that I wouldn't go to for my kids. Right. And probably speak for you on that as well. And most good people would probably agree. And so that is very frustrating, because again, just like you said, you can have the digital footprint, you can have basically all the evidence in the world, but if you don't have the victim, basically the case is less likely to be prosecuted to its fullest extent. Correct. Is that what you're saying?
So if you don't have a victim, they won't even prosecute the case. And
so with the victim, is there like, I mean, obviously they're probably scared. They're probably nervous. They're probably, I can't imagine the emotions you're feeling. I mean, obviously there's got to be some type of physical protection for them. Because obviously they're protected from the law, I would assume, for the most part. But is there any type of physical protection from them?
No. So that's the problem. First of all, human trafficking survivors, unfortunately, a majority of them are the worst witnesses, right? Because defense attorneys can eat them apart. And it takes the strongest human beings in the world to sit on a stand in a human trafficking case. The survivors that do that, they weren't rescued by law enforcement. They weren't rescued by a nonprofit. When they have come to that point in their life where they're ready to testify against their trafficker, they've rescued themselves. And so it's insane. They don't have any protections. They might be at a safe house somewhere. They might have been able to cut off all ties, but they're also trying to now rebuild their lives and recover and heal. And then finding these victims, they scatter to the wind too during these cases. And some of these cases take 3, 4, 5 years to prosecute. It's very difficult. There's a case that we worked with Deliver Fund, and the victim got drilled for 14 hours on the stand by the defense attorney after the trafficker used the funds that he took from her industrialized rape to pay for that attorney. And she sat there for 14 hours taking criticism from that defense attorney that was eating her apart, and her car was stolen by one of the traffickers' friend in the parking lot while she was being, while she was testifying at a federal courthouse. He had his friend come steal her car.
Yeah. So I'm going to say this. Imagine being a defense attorney, knowing the evidence, seeing the evidence, and defending a human trafficker. Man, what a piece of shit.
Right.
I can't imagine being a defense attorney and going, I'm going to fight for this guy's freedoms for $500 an hour. And I don't give a shit what happens to this child, to this mother who's been abused, and that's unfortunate. So you defense attorneys out there, go play in traffic.
And, you know, in a lot of those cases, though, they, like, a large majority of them end up taking public defenders, which, I mean, those guys don't even have a choice, and they have to do to their best of ability. And I would think some of the public defenders might just breathe a sigh of relief when they're like, I'm just going to have to talk him into playing out, when they see that there's so much overwhelming digital evidence. Because, like, all the cases that we've specifically associated with at Deliver Fund, there's so much digital evidence. Even up to the last minute, they're talking like they're going to testify, and then they end up playing out because they're going to get 20, 40, 60 years, and they'll plea out for like 12, 13 years.
I can't imagine being a defense attorney. And I morally cannot wrap my head around looking at this evidence, knowing, and again, at the end, I mean, because I understand some cases are stronger than others, right? I can't imagine looking at the evidence of an, like, overwhelmingly case and being like, yeah, man, we're going to try to, like, get you off. I have a hard time morally. Like, I wouldn't be able to do it. There's no amount of money in this world where you could pay me in order to do that. But that, you know, again, that's just unfortunately the world we live in. Some of the pitfalls there. But you said 96% are female victims, correct? So that 4% of male victims, what does that look like?
So male victims, and then also the what would be considered gender minorities, which they actually are trafficked at a higher rate because they have more vulnerabilities, right? So they're extremely vulnerable, and a trafficker looks for those vulnerabilities to exploit them. They're looking for that God void to fill in that person's heart and mentally manipulate them into that situation. So those gender minorities and those males that are being trafficked, a lot of the times they're a lot younger. A lot of the times they may have been gay and they didn't want to come out with it. They meet somebody online and that person ends up befriending them, and they look to target that person to exploit them. I've also seen transvestites that are trafficked. And because there is a large market out there to purchase them for fetish purposes.
Sure.
And I never even knew that world until I came across it on an operation where I'm like, oh my God, I haven't ever seen a transvestite come in to be offered services. And then, you know, you find out that transvestite is selling herself because her little sister, who is a child, like in her teens, has a drug addiction. And her trafficker is forcing the transvestite to go make that money to pay off her little sister's drug addiction. Or that trafficker, drug dealer goes, if you don't do it, I'm going to make her do it. And so you have a transvestite who has a little sister sibling who's trying to protect her. Right? Do you see that situation? There's a bazillion different situations, but they all look the same, whether they're male or female. It's somebody who has an exposed vulnerability that can be manipulated. And so that the transvestite's vulnerability is that their little sister is going to be exploited. It's a leverage.
It's a leverage factor. And that too, is just, you know, just like you said, and this kind of goes back to, like, you know, a solid family home, you know, might help that. Cause there's been videos that I've seen of, particularly, I think there's one, he's kind of an older, I don't want to call him a gentleman, an older guy, He was a child predator, and he talks about what he would look for in trying to manipulate kids or even adults into, you know, sexual exploitation or sexual acts. And he was like, you know, it was always weak, no dad, no, like no real family structure, just lost people. And then we was like, we would, you know, show them that family structure, give them that false sense of family structure, and then be able to manipulate them into doing basically whatever we want. And so when it comes to kids, is that similar thing of what you're seeing?
Yeah. So when it comes to child trafficking in the US, I break it down into two sections. You have the minors that are small and little and that are tiny that do get trafficked. And the large majority of that trafficking is actually familial trafficking. So it's a mom, a dad, an aunt, or an uncle that's taking that child and exploiting them before they hit puberty, right? Once they hit puberty, they can be manipulated and sold more openly. And so there's two separate places. And the ones that are more likely to be sold openly are going to be approached by people that are not their family, but then they get to know them and manipulate them. But the majority of child sex trafficking victims in the United States do have that broken home scenario. They are much more vulnerable. They're many of them, and it's in the very high percentages. I don't want to quote it, but trafficking victims that have been recovered that were minors have been in the child welfare system, were through, you know, in foster care at some point in their life. And so they did have that emptiness. They were likely sexually exploited when they were children or abused by family members. That's where traffickers and predators look, is for somebody that has already been broken down in some way, shape, or form in order to manipulate them further. There's definitely, if you have a girl that is raised in a nuclear family who has a strong father figure, who, you know, has extracurricular activities, she has more armor on.
Absolutely.
Right? She has confidence. She has drive. She has people she knows she could speak to and fall back on. She has her parents that are setting regulations on her internet usage, right? Where a large majority of traffickers find these people on the internet. It's a numbers game for them. They slide into their DMs. It doesn't mean she can't be trafficked. There's been situations where that upper middle class girl, it gets rebellious in high school. We all did it, right? She started partying, she started drinking, and she started meeting up with these people who were partying. And she became really good friends with one of the girls, right? Who was a little bit older. And she's like, I want to be like you. I want to have that purse. I want to be that way. She gets caught. She gets grounded by her parents, right? She is about to go on scholarship to go to whatever nice school it is. And he's still letting his daughter go to the gym to work out because she needs to stay shape for her scholarship. The girl ditches her phone and everything at the gym to go out partying that night. And she doesn't come back. Right. So it can happen to anybody. It's just a little bit harder. And I mean, that trafficker used one of his victims as the recruiter to recruit that girl in, and it took 6 to 8 months to gain that girl's trust and to get her into the
So it's more of a process of so would you say that the majority of victims, it's a whole process, right?
It's the grooming process.
Establishing the trust. Okay. So it's not just like you're at the grocery store and somebody snatches your kid, throws them in a van, and is gone.
No.
I mean, that does happen, yes.
Yeah, so but, rarely.
But it's not.
So the snatch and grab does happen, but they're not going to sell that person, right? Because in order for a victim to make money, especially in the domestic sex trafficking industry, they have to be left alone in a room and have sex with a stranger and make that money, right? So they have to be manipulated. They have to be influenced in some way to do that. So those stupid posts online of there's a zip tie on my car door or whatever at the Target. Somebody's following me in Target. I'm not saying that's not happening, those are usually targeted for assault and violent crimes and theft, right? They marked your car because they want to steal its catalytic converter.
Right. They don't want you.
Or they might want to beat you and take your purse, because there are criminals out there that do that. But they're not going to target me at Target or Walmart because they think they're going to be able to sell me. They're going to find value in me in some way, shape, or form through violent crime, but they're not going to sell me. And, you know, there are snatch and grabs by children, but it's like something up in like the 96th percentile. Children that are kidnapped are actually usually kidnapped by people that they know, parental aunts, uncles.
Right. Bad divorce.
Yeah. And there are situations where children are kidnapped and they're taken away and they're stuffed in a box for 6 or 7 years. It happens. I'm not saying it doesn't, but when it comes to stranger kidnappings, whether it be children or adults, like completely stranger, no contact, the likelihood of that actually ending up in a trafficking situation is like extremely low. Parents have to stop worrying that their kid's going to be taken from them or their teenager is going to be kidnapped at the gas station and be sold as a trafficking victim, and start paying attention to your kid's social media. Who's sliding into the DMs? Who is talking to them? Have you vetted their coach or the other parents that are going on the trips for that swim meet?
Yeah.
Like your new front door of don't open the door to the stranger is right here. It's the social media. It's the connection throughout the world in real time. And teaching your kids and your teenagers stranger danger, and teaching them about themselves and their vulnerabilities and their strengths and their weaknesses is going to create an armor against trafficking more than, you know, screaming at the guy following you in the Target.
You actually brought up a really good point. I am very weird. I'm one of those parents, you drop your kids off at daycare, you do that kind of stuff. Like, you know, their teachers, like, I'm just one of those. Cause again, being in law enforcement, you think differently than most people. Are having some type of intelligence background, you think differently than most people. You're not just like, oh, my kid's going to school. Great. I'm like, I went to my kid's school before and I was like looking at the door frames, looking at the security, looking at just processing everything, talking to the teachers, looking at them in the eye, like just, you know, what's their name? What's their last name? All, you know, kind of all these things. And just, you know, just like you said, like you go on a club soccer trip with the team, what parents are going. I mean, you're going to a new location, lots of variables to take into consideration. That's, you know, again, you're not being overprotective. You're just being smart at that point. I think there's a big difference.
Yeah. And that's the part of understanding what human trafficking is and what it isn't, which will help you, you know, quell your fears of that trafficking mindset, but never try to quell your fears of just being a protective parent. You should always be a protective parent. I think sometimes people mistake me for going, oh, don't even worry about it. I'm like, no, you're worrying about the wrong things. Like you're distracted.
Gotta worry about
when
it.
when I say that's not human trafficking, it's because it isn't. I'm like, but you know, your purse is gonna get snapped. Like,
yeah.
It's like you're not being, you know, aware of your surroundings when you're walking to your car properly.
Yeah. And I think, and you know, I think people too, this is the harsh reality of, I guess you could just say violence in general. If you haven't experienced it or you're not familiar with it, you're not educated on the topic, you're unaware it exists. Right. So like if you've never had to deal with human trafficking or domestic or violence in general, you've never been, you know, involved in violence, you're not going to know what that is until it happens. And that's where it's unfortunate. That's where you should be prepared. You know, obviously the training is huge, being prepared, whether it's with tools, your physical body. One thing I kind of want to talk about switching gears here is the human trafficking into the United States from other countries. Is that because I know you said you guys deal mostly like with the domestic side, but what about the international side of people coming in or people coming out?
Yeah. So primarily what I've been focusing on this conversation has been domestic sex trafficking. And so there's many different forms of trafficking out there, sex trafficking, labor trafficking, child brides, debt bondage, organ trafficking, right? There's a lot.
Like, right, yeah, yeah.
We can't sit here for 7 hours to cover it all. But when it comes to international trafficking, first and foremost, let me just say about 80% of the human trafficking in the United States is happening to Americans by Americans. The international trafficking that's coming over is mostly happening in very legal means, like people getting visas and then being manipulated into doing other things, like specifically labor trafficking, like in the migrant workers that come over here, and they're just treated egregiously. I will say that everybody kind of gets manipulated and pulled with buzzwords by politicians and by media that our southern border trafficking is coming over. Everybody scream, right? That's not the case specifically. Trafficking is happening down there, but what is actually happening is human smuggling. And human smuggling and human trafficking are two completely different crimes. Yes, they have very correlated variables, right? So smuggling is when somebody pays somebody to bring them across the border, and it's actually a crime against the United States. Trafficking is when somebody is unwillingly brought somewhere and held against their will. And with human trafficking, there doesn't need to even be movement. With smuggling, there has to be movement. Now, at the southern border, what we're seeing, though, with smuggled persons is that they're extremely vulnerable to being trafficked. So it's like, you know, shooting fish in a barrel for a trafficker to sit there at the southern border and offer these people a better life and then traffic them once they get across. What we're also seeing too are the smugglers themselves holding them in what would be a debt bondage. So they're originally smuggled and they get here and they pay the $7,000 to $8,000 to be coyoted across. And then their smugglers turn around and go, "You owe me another $20,000. And they're in this perpetual debt bondage to their smuggler, which is now trafficking. And what's really sad is we're seeing this coming up over the southern border, and it's turning into more crime because they're going to do everything they can, because the hold that they have over them is their own life. And they also know all their family still back in their home country down south, and they threaten their lives. And we're seeing an increase in that. And, you know, we're also seeing the increase in the unaccompanied minors coming across. They're getting placed in places. And there was a New York Times article that just came out. They did an amazing job where they highlighted that these documented, they came across, they were given sanctuary. Minors are being put into factories here and working all night. And then they're going to school the next morning. And so there's a child labor aspect now that is taking place and being exploited on certain levels, whether it be in factories, farms, you know, meatpacking facilities, they're seeing it happen. And so we're seeing an increase in that happening. Another international aspect are like the illicit massage businesses. And they're bringing in, they're primarily from Asia. They get them here on legal visas, and then they're moving them constantly around to these illicit businesses, forcing them to provide sex acts for extra tips. And then that money goes back out overseas. So that's what you're going to see in the domestic sex trafficking versus the international trafficking that's taking place.
Now, again, is this mostly done online? Like they're setting it up online, particularly more of the smuggling stuff. They're setting it up online. There's obviously some type of transaction, or is it just like a guarantee when you come over, I'm going to come pick you up from here and I'm going to take you here. And then that's when they start to manipulate.
Yeah. So you're going to see a lot of word of mouth in their home country, but they also post like ads to lure people in on like bulletin boards and different things, promising of a better life. I mean, there's a reason why we have such an influx of people from the southern border, like at the southern border. It's not just Mexico, it's Venezuela, it's Colombia. These people are in situations in countries where they are desperate and they know they can make a better life for themselves here. And so that vulnerability right there gets exploited by these people and these smugglers. And so you'll see it. It does backtrack online into different chat groups, like on Discord and different things, even on some social media platforms to initially bring them over. But I mean, it's a very rich market for traffickers to make their money that way.
And you actually posted on your Instagram page. You'll post some of these traffickers that are flaunting their money or flaunting their victims, whatever the case may be. And the fact that social media is allowing that to even stand on their platform is relatively frustrating, especially considering some of the stuff they do censor. But yet they allow something like this, which is kind of very frustrating. From your knowledge, is there any type of social media regulation on content as it pertains to human trafficking or human smuggling?
They're against exploitation and the sale of even illicit commodities on their platforms. But like the stuff that I post, it's from the domestic sex trafficking industry side mainly. Law enforcement's going to love this. It's only reasonable suspicion. Unless an actual transaction takes place, is freedom of expression and art. That's what social media can shove it off as. Unless they have like somebody just talking about, oh, my girl, she brought me she brought me $1,000 and I didn't even have to talk to her all day. I've got her on lock. She's on automatic. Tell me how that is an actual
what does that mean?
Crime.
Like, yeah.
Sorry, it's a different language. Yeah. So I did have to learn a new culture, but like it's a different language,
sure.
But a cop can get reasonable suspicion from that, right? They can see that. But with human trafficking, you have to actually have a transaction in place. I mean, it's the same with murder for hire. Somebody could say, I want to hire that guy to kill you. But until you exchange money, the cop you can't charge him, right? So
you just don't have much. I mean, you can have conspiracy and all that other stuff, but yeah, like you don't have much. It's not as severe, right? Like again, if you have, it's just like you said, without a victim, it's very hard to do anything.
It is, yeah.
Right. So you can have that. Yeah, that could be very frustrating.
Massively frustrating. Because I can literally all day find them for you online, all day long. It could be my full-time job if I wanted it to be. And so social media in itself, though, I mean, there needs to be changes to the laws for social media, which is, you know, coming up there towards the Supreme Court. There's some arguments that are probably going to be decided on during this next Supreme Court session that might actually change the liabilities for social media companies. So we'll be watching that really closely. But it's just a perpetuation of the blind eye that we turn, right? You were talking about parents paying attention. Social media in itself, it makes some money on their users. So why would they just delete their users off of suspicion? They want to bring people to their platforms. So they really have to have their arm tied behind them by the law for them to actually do anything. And, you know, people aren't even going to get mad about this to give them that outside influence and pressure because of the, you know, the myths and lies about the zip ties and the fentanyl laced roses and stuff that aren't trafficking, because a majority of America would much rather believe a very comfortable lie to them because they don't think it could ever happen, that they would sniff a fentanyl, that wouldn't happen to me or my family. They would rather believe that than the uncomfortable truth while you're sharing that post on your social media that your daughter has a trafficker in her inbox who's making her fall in love with him through poetry.
Yeah.
Right?
No, that's true stuff. I mean, because you hear crazy stories, which kind of makes me want to discuss the media stuff. And you and I were kind of talking about like the truth of the media. And of course, in the past, you could probably say the past 5 years, especially, the media is a tool for politicians to get away with things, to drive fear, to drive emotion, to drive all these kinds of things that make people somewhat irrational right now. So from, you know, from your perspective, how should someone, because again, like you'll see these things like, oh, 32 people discovered in a house in Ohio, or, you know, kids being like all, you know, kind of all this stuff. How can we differentiate? Because obviously, just like we talked about, there's, you know, three sides to every story. But what do you think about, you know, kind of these headlines and things like that? And how should people read that and process that information?
So the first and foremost, media, I don't care what side of the aisle you are on, they are there to make money and they are there for your clicks. They're there to take sensationalism. If it bleeds, it leads, and make money off of you. And so when you see those things, like if it's the media, read into it more and kind of try to understand it. And a lot of the times media will mislabel trafficking incidents incorrectly, or it's a full on trafficking incident and they never say the word trafficking at all. And I'm like, come on, you guys, like,
right,
get it together. Always go to, you know, reliable sources. So, you know, Deliver Fund or myself, I think I answer probably 20 to 30 questions a day in my DMs of, is this real? And then I will respond and I will break it down. I'm like, this is not a trafficking scenario, or like, yes, this is trafficking, you know, that information. Right. Polaris is another really great resource of information. They dispel myths. They also have a lot of good information on human trafficking in general. They're the ones that are in charge of the human trafficking hotline here in the United States to take those calls. They have really great stuff. Trusted people, even your, you know, your local law enforcement agency, they have a Facebook page, like, and you hear something's happening, like, even then their, you know, their media person might put something out. If there's like, I see it all the time. I see local, like, law enforcement agencies going, that is not happening. You don't need to be worried about that kind of thing. So that's where law enforcement can also step in. If they're hearing rumors and things that are being pushed all over social media and putting your community into a whole tizzy about what's going on, there's nothing wrong with quelling them and educating them. Because I find in local communities, especially on the Nextdoor app and on Facebook and like the local one here, there's actually a lot of cops I know that are in there on their personal, and they'll like respond to people's questions. You'll never know they're a cop. And if their chief knew that, they'd probably be in trouble. But like, you know, community outreach in general and dispelling rumors and myths, not just from trafficking, but other crimes that are taking place in your area, and doing that community outreach is really important.
Yeah. I again, because the media can be a great tool. It can also be a tool of manipulation. And so I think that's, again, just like you said before, take everything as a grain of salt. But this was extremely eye-opening. This was, you are a plethora of information. And I also appreciate what you do. I've been following you for quite some time. I listened to you on Andy's podcast. I think what you guys do at Deliver Fund is the Lord's work. Whether you're religious or not, morally, you guys are doing good in this world. And so, for those listening, please support Deliver Fund in any way you can. We will be doing another, we're going to be doing some rash guards and some shorts for Deliver Fund as well. So you guys, please, 100% of the proceeds go towards, Deliver Fund. I think we donated a little over 12,000, a couple months ago to you guys. And, it's awesome. They go down, you guys actually break down where the money goes to, which I think is huge. And they're doing work here in America, which I think is also very beneficial. There's some other people there that are doing some great stuff, but we got to take care of ourselves here and take care of our family here. So, Kara, where can people find you and where can people reach you?
So if you want to follow me personally, I'm on Instagram at Kara_the_Huntress. So Kara the Huntress. And then to support and follow Deliver Fund, it's at Deliver Fund across all aspects of social media, even LinkedIn. We have lots of informative stuff on YouTube. You want to learn more and how you can help, deliverfund.org has so many resources, just even like the basic identifiers, how to keep your kids safe, all of that stuff. And gosh, thank you so much for having me. I couldn't be more grateful for your support, your community support, and shedding a light on what human trafficking is and how it can be how it can be fought.
Yeah, and we'll definitely have you back. I would love to have you back. I feel like there's so much more we could dive into as it pertains to what you guys do with law enforcement. And maybe we'll have a part two or even part three of this podcast, because I think this is something that needs to be addressed, because it is a major issue, and there is not much training on it for law enforcement. So guys, I'll put the links to CARE's Instagram, Deliver Fund's Instagram, and how you can support them in their fight against human trafficking and child exploitation. So Karen, thank you so much for your time, and we'll do this again very soon.
Sounds good. Thank you so much. Have a good one.
Of course. Thank you for listening. Links in the show notes below if you'd like to follow Kara or Deliver Fund. Be sure to subscribe to the podcast so you never miss an episode. New episodes will launch on Monday every other week.